from the studios of Kootenai Co-op Radio, this is Deconstructing Dinner.
And welcome to Deconstructing Dinner, a weekly radio show and podcast produced at Kootenai Co-op Radio, CJLY, in Nelson, British Columbia. Deconstructing Dinner is heard on radio stations around the world, including CJMQ, Sherbrooke, Quebec. I'm John Steinman. Today's episode is truly in the spirit of deconstructing our food and features a talk delivered by Andrew Smith, a writer and lecturer on food and culinary history. His latest book is titled Eating History: 30 Turning Points in the Making of American Cuisine. Andrew teaches culinary history at the New School in New York City. He's the editor-in-chief of the Oxford Encyclopedia of Food and Drink in America, and he's the author or editor of 14 other books, including The Tomato in America, Early History, Culture, and Cookery, and Popped Culture, A Social History of Popcorn in America. Andrew was recorded speaking in November 2009 at the Kansas City Public Library in Kansas City, Missouri. Launching his talk in November 2009, New York's Andrew Smith first engaged the audience in a dialogue on what kind of food they would prefer: organic or conventional, local or global, genetically manipulated or not. Of course, the audience chose the options that are the least available, and in a quest to understand how this came to be, that the foods we want the most are the foods that are hardest to find, Andrew Smith authored Eating History, in which he speaks of 30 distinct shifts in American food culture that forever changed the way North Americans eat food.
So the point that I'm raising isn't to discuss culinary hypocrisy, saying we prefer one system, in fact we eat in another. It's really to say that I'm a culinary historian, and the system that you all prefer is exactly the type of system that was around here in 1800. There was only organic food. There were no petrochemical fertilizers. There were no insecticides at all, which surprised me. I had expected to find tobacco and other things being used as insecticides, but there were no insecticides that I found. In addition to that, virtually all food was local. There were exceptions. Coffee, tea, and some of the spices were actually imported from abroad. But most, mainly food was local. And so my question, which I began with 5 years ago, was why did we change? And so what I started with was the idea there's 15 turning points in culinary history about where system changed from one system into another system. And I wrote up my 15 points and I sent it off to Columbia University Press, and they sent it out to real historians. And the real historians said, well, this is a good idea, but you really can't exclude this. This is a really important topic. You've got to put this in here. And I said, oh, yeah, that makes some sense. So I got it up to 20 really turning points. And then I started writing and I got it up to 25. And then I got it to 30, and when I got to 33, Columbia University Press said, forget it, you know, this is the end. So I understand the process of publication, so I removed three of the chapters, and three of the chapters had to do with beverages, and then I pitched Columbia University Press and saying, you now need a companion to this drinking history, which I'm delighted to say I'm under contract now to do. So in any case, this is how these 30 events were created. There's a little more thought to them. One of the thoughts, I want to start with an experience I had about 15 years ago. I went to a ketchup-making factory. Have any of you ever been to a ketchup-making factory or a food factory in general? A couple of you have. This happened to be in Ohio. It happened to be by the Heinz Corporation. And they took me out at 4 a.m. in the morning out to a farm. And the farm was not far from the factory at all. And they put me onto a truck that was paralleling a harvester. The harvester would go along the fields, pick up the tomatoes, dump anything out the back that was green. I don't know how it did it, but it had electric eye in there. Any tomato that wasn't exactly the right color, it broke the tomato apart and shot it out the back. The good tomatoes, it put onto the truck next to it. The truck then drove to the factory. It was about 3 minutes away. The tomatoes were put into a flue. The flue came up to the top of water bath. There was only time from the beginning of the point where the tomato was actually planted till the time that you picked up the bottle of ketchup that it might have been touched by human hands. was at the top of the flu, where in this case women were charged with the task, saying anything that the electric eye missed, they were to pick it out. And I was amazed. I could have a conversation with me and simultaneously pick things out. I guess if you're experienced, you can do that sort of thing. I couldn't. In any case, those tomatoes were then put into, they were ground up, they were put into a large bath, and they were, the secret ingredients were put in. The secret ingredients aren't secret. Anybody who knows botany and biology can figure out exactly what they are. What was secret was the equipment that got it there. And then they were put automatically into a bottling machine, which was right there. And they were automatically put onto a pallet. The pallet was automatically put onto a truck. From the beginning of the process of going out to the field till the time that it came out the other end was 2 hours, the total length of time that it took to do this preparation. And I looked at that, and I, whether you like ketchup or not, I looked at that and said, that's amazing. I tried to make ketchup. Have any of you ever tried to make ketchup? I have lots of recipes. It's tough to do, and you can never get it the same color that the Heinz does, and you can never get it the same taste there. But I was impressed with how that worked out. And so first question that I asked was, where did this start? And my answer was a man by the name of Oliver Evans. Does Oliver Evans ring a bell with anybody in here? Most Americans don't know anything about Oliver Evans. Oliver Evans was a man who was into innovations during the time of the American Revolution. He signed up to be in the American Army, but there's no evidence that he ever actually served in it. But he decided that he wanted to be a wire maker. He made wire for a while. He figured out a better way to make wire. And then he decided he wanted to be a grocer in Delaware. And the people that, in fact, worked with him were those farmers that had mills. And he paid a lot of attention to the milling technology of the time. Does any of you know what a milling technology would have been like in the 18th century? What would it have been like? It's pretty primitive. It has stone. It would have had usually a family operation. There would have been five or six people that would have operated that. Virtually every community in America would have had one or more mills. So there were 30 to 40,000 mills in America. And when you didn't have water power, which was obviously important in New England, you had wind power, you had animal power, and you had human power when all else failed. So you had to be able to figure out a way to grind the grain in order to make flour. So Oliver Evans took one look at this and said, we don't need all these people here. We can do this by putting buckets and elevators and all sorts of connections. We can take the grain from the cart that comes and wagon and comes, put it up to the top, have it go through all these processes, and then at the other end, we just have another wagon on the other end and dump the flour into. If you want to hold up the bags, you can. If you want to just put it directly into the wagon, you can do that too. And he, in fact, was the third person to receive a patent from the U.S. Patent Agency, and he presented this as the whole new technology. Now, I know this is going to surprise you, but millers of the time didn't like this at all. Why wouldn't millers like this? Anybody? They didn't need it. You know, why need it? And looking at it, it would mean they would be out of a job. So they decided this wasn't for them. So the technology only took off in those new areas of the country that were beginning to grow grain, that could produce a great deal of it and didn't have a group of people that were already invested in this process. That happened to be Western New York. Now, how many of you think of Western New York as the grain basket of the United States? Prior to this, by the way, the grain basket of the United States was New Jersey, downstate New York, and Pennsylvania, with some production in Maryland and some production in Northern Virginia. But that's where the grain basket was. Now, what happened was, my second story here happens to do with the Erie Canal. How many of you know about the Erie Canal? How many of you know the Erie Canal boat song? I can tell those of us who had a progressive education, we know the real truth behind the Erie Canal boat song. I was going to bring it to you and have us sing it for you, but I'm going to pass on that. You're just going to have to Google it and find out the Erie Canal boat song. So in any case, the Erie Canal starts off in New York in 1817. It's constructed and completed in 1825. Even before the canal was completed, the milling industry had moved from where it had originally been to Rochester. Rochester is the largest milling city in the world by 1840. So you had this huge shift and change that went out there. You had huge production of grain in western New York. And unfortunately, they didn't know much about fertilizers, and they didn't know much about pesticides, and they didn't know much about a lot of other things, and the land in western New York soon you could no longer raise the amount of grain that you could before. And so with the canal opening up, they decided to move elsewhere, and they moved into the Midwest. So you had this huge change going along. The milling technology that Oliver Evans created went right along with this. And the milling technology also went to Europe. And it was the Europeans that took one look at this and said, this is called scientific milling. It is exactly the type of milling that we need here. And they began to make advances on it. And one of the advances was, rather than using stones, which would typically have been part of the milling process, they shifted first to iron and then to steel. Now, the steel technology will come back into the United States, and that will be where the Midwest begins to take off, the upper Midwest in particular, where it will grow and can grow hard-grained wheat or hard wheat, which couldn't do prior to that time. You couldn't use the milling instruments of the time. So the milling industry moves aside. Not everybody was happy with these changes, and one person in particular really was upset with them. Anyone know who that person was? I mentioned him on the radio today. You might have had one of his graham crackers or a graham cracker named after him. It's called Graham, and his first name was Sylvester. Sylvester Graham was a failure throughout much of his life. Then he became a Methodist minister. He was a tremendous success being a Methodist minister. He was offered a job in the Temperance Society in Philadelphia. Temperance really has its beginnings in the United States, not as religion, a particular concern, but it was a medical concern. The best estimate that in America at the time in the 1830s was that about 25% of the total calories consumed by Americans was alcohol. And the amount of alcohol that the founding fathers consumed was prodigious by any standards. And all I can do is John Adams, who is not really known as one of the more frivolous founding fathers, consumed a tankard of hard cider every single day. Get his juices rolling. I can see that now. In any case, he was concerned on temperance, and he got into the Temperance Society, which was done by medical professionals at the time, and saying alcoholism is a real serious problem in America. And he started studying all the medical texts of the day, and they are voluminous. He read them all and concluded, it's not alcohol that's the problem. It's overconsumption of food. How many of you have heard this before? Overconsumption of food. We're talking 1830. Now, no one would have paid any attention to Sylvester Graham except that cholera became a real threat in the United States. Cholera starts off in India and gets to Europe in the 1820s, and Americans know there's only a amount of time when cholera is going to hit the United States as well. And so Graham has this great idea. If you only follow his rules for eating and drinking, you will not get cholera. Now, parts of his rules were, by the way, consume grain that you grow yourself, only consume flour that you ground yourself or has been ground locally, only consume raw food. Most of his food that he consumed was raw food. And don't drink any alcohol. Don't eat any ketchup. This is where I got off on him. As soon as he said he didn't like ketchup, I knew that there was something wrong with this guy. But he did make a huge change here. And part of this change, he took one look at this and said, if you only follow my strictures, then you will not get cholera. And he had another stricture, don't drink water. Now, I know this sounds strange. No one really drank water in the early 19th century, but he made it a point to boil the water before you would consume it if you were going to consume it, and do a number of other things. If you know anything about cholera, one of the main ways that it is transmitted, there are other ways, but is actually through the water. So sure enough, everybody that followed his principles all of a sudden didn't get cholera, or at least that's what he claimed. And not opposed to advertising and promoting his views. He happened to print them all up, and he happened to make nice booklets out of them and say how wonderful it is with all these testimonials from people who followed his principles. Now, I want to talk about one of his principles. He liked bread, but he believed that bread could only be made by the mother of the house. That bakers were doing bad things to bread. What might bakers be doing at the time that would be bad? Well, one of the things that he was really worried about was the fermentation that occurred in bread. In order to make bread, you really need to ferment it. And for him, that was creating alcohol. And so he believed that the bread of the time that the bakers made were in fact doing this. So he was going to create bread without yeast. I don't know quite how he did that, but in any case, he does have a whole book on how one makes bread. Now, the interesting thing about this is he said bakers at the time were putting in a lot of things to make it white. Now, I can't tell you why Europeans and Americans liked white bread, but it goes back 2,500 years to Roman and Greek times. The idea that white bread was better than brown bread. We all know that shifts in the 1970s. Brown bread is better than white bread, but at this time, he does. In order to get the flour white, how would you get flour white in the early... you'd use the sun, and if you had sun, you were in good shape. You'd actually put it out in the sun, and insects would come by and eat what they liked, and what they didn't like, you would end up with. But you could bleach it. Somebody said bleach it. How many of you like bleached flour? Does that sound good? How many of you would consume bleached flour? If you consume flour, all the flour today is bleached. There is no flour out there, as far as I know. There may be some local brand that are out there, but it's actually bleach is put in with the flour in order to turn it white because it is not naturally that color. But they would also do other things. They would put in plaster. Plaster's good. Now, you're all saying, ooh, plaster tastes good. What's wrong with plaster? It's white, and it's about the same color. And really, it weighs more than the flour. So when you weigh the bread, which is how they sold it, by weight, it would weigh more. So in any case, there were abuses of bakers at the time. And Sylvester Graham was opposed to that. And he only wanted the mother to do it. But he said, even if the baker didn't bleach it, even if they didn't put in plaster and other extraneous products in it, he still thought that the mother's bread was better because she put love in it. And isn't that true? I mean, when you think about it, those of you who bake your own bread, do any of you bake your own bread? If you do, isn't love one of the ingredients that goes into it? We've got some nods here. And I think that's part of one of the wonderful things about home cooking is that the love does go into it, and it does make a difference. So now, I used to grow tomatoes. I don't anymore, but I used to grow tomatoes, and I calculated the cost of me when my time was into that. Each tomato would be worth about $7.28. If I put my tomatoes into a farmer's market and put that price on them, I wouldn't buy them, even if I knew that they were mine, all right? But since I grew them, it seems to me that that's something special, and I like that. I hope that all of you are inclined to grow your own food to the extent that you can.
This is Deconstructing Dinner. We're listening to author Andrew Smith, speaking in November 2009 in Kansas City, Missouri. Andrew is the author of Eating History, 30 Turning Points in the Making of American Cuisine. Today's episode is archived online at deconstructingdinner.ca and listed under the December 17th, 2009 episode. As Andrew continues, he speaks of Reverend Sylvester Graham, an advocate of dietary reform in the early mid-19th century.
So you had a huge shift and change, a huge protest movement. I can't begin to tell you the thousands of people that showed up to listen to Sylvester Graham lecture. And he is the first American to actually develop a whole theory of food. He connected it with a whole lot of other things, which I won't go into in depth, but he thought that anything stimulating was bad for the body. And part of this, anything stimulating, we won't get into in depth, but the whole idea was, it goes back to part of Christian tradition, this love-hate affair with the body and the love-hate affair with food. So this has been a part, this dualism has been there, and Sylvester Graham brings it back. His view is food should not taste good. If it tasted good, it was bad for you. And it was bad for you because it would get you to overeat. So just like wine and beer and ale and cider were bad for you because they would get you to drink more if you liked them. So his goal was anything stimulating was bad for you. And that's part of a movement that goes on. He creates a movement that will expand and continues today in many ways. He will influence a whole lot of hydrotherapists. Many of you are practitioners of hydrotherapists. How many of you are practitioners of hydrotherapists in here? None of you want to raise your hand. Some of you are willing to give it a shot. These were medical professionals in the 1840s who believed you should take bath once a week. Now, you may think that doesn't sound good. All I can do is say, comparison to the number of baths that Americans took in the 1840s. That's really good. And they also believed that drinking water was good, and health spas were a part of that movement. And so you had health spa opening up in New York by the man by the name of James Caleb Jackson. Name ring a bell with anybody? He created a product called Granula. Does anyone ever hear of Granula? No, none of you heard of Granula. Well, all he would do is take gram flour, which is unbleached, and with all of the germ and with all of the even the casing on the outside of the flour put into it, he would bake it twice, then he would break it up, and then he would serve it. And because Jackson happened to be a vegetarian as well, you would not consume that with milk, but you would consume it with water. This will come into America as another name. Somebody else is going to grab the attention of Americans on this. Anybody know the name of this commercial cereal today? Grape nuts, yeah. The first granola becomes grape nuts, and C.W. Post is going to promote that a little later on. In any case, you take the granola, and now we have another person coming into this, and it's Ellen White. Does anyone know Ellen White? Is this name ring a bell with anybody? Are you Seventh-day Adventists? No? You just know about it. It's okay. You can be. It's all right. We have no objection. She did visit Jackson and said, this is the type of food and the type of philosophy that we want to instill in our religion. And while vegetarianism is not a requirement, Seventh-day Adventist Church, it is encouraged for health reasons, not for religious reasons. And much of the simple types of foods were certainly encouraged in the 1840s. She goes back to the center, which at that point happened to be a strange place in Michigan. I don't know the name of it. Does somebody know the name of the place in Michigan? Battle Creek, okay. Anybody hear of Battle Creek, Michigan? And she decides she's going to create a spa. And so she creates a spa there, but the trouble is it's a failure. No one really wants to go to the Seventh-day Adventist spa, particularly when they find out, unlike Jackson's spa, you could play cards at night and you could dance at night. No dancing and card playing at this spa in Battle Creek, Michigan, all right? So they say, this isn't the greatest place in the world. We don't want to do this. But she finds a teenager there who's read all of Sylvester Graham's work, and his name is, anybody? John Harvey Kellogg. How many of you have heard of John Harvey Kellogg? Most people actually haven't. John Harvey Kellogg is probably the premier medical professional in the late 19th century, early 20th century, and he is a vegetarian, and he does take over the spa in Battle Creek, Michigan, and among the first things that he does, he's a vegetarian, and one of the things that he does is trying to figure out what products that can be served there. He takes granola from Jackson and says, okay, fine, we're going to create the same product, and then we're going to sell it. Jackson was not happy with this idea of him taking that idea. And there actually was a huge lawsuit about it. So John Harvey Kellogg says, fine, okay, I'll make up my own formula for it, and I'm going to change its name. And the name is changed to? Not grape nuts. Granola. This is the first granola. It looks like grape nuts. It is, in fact, what C.W. Post steals from the sanitarium and creates as a commercial product, but that's the product that they start with. So you have this coming in. Now, there's another man that comes in by the name of Schumacher. Schumacher happens to be a German immigrant that comes in, and he decides that Americans need to eat oats. How many of you eat oats? At the time, most Americans did not eat oats. Why wouldn't Americans eat oats at the time? It's horses. That's what horses eat, all right? Americans eat, we eat corn. We eat wheat. We don't eat oats. Now, if you're of Scottish derivation, you eat oats. If you're of Irish derivation, you eat oats. If you're of German derivation, you eat oats. And so Schumacher comes along and says, okay, fine, we're going to make some oats. And he begins selling them to the ethnic communities that had developed in America at the time. And then he happens to go to the 1876 Centennial Fair in Philadelphia. Anyone know of the Centennial Fair in Philadelphia? It is the most incredible event in America in the late 19th century. There is nothing like it. 10 million people go in a six-month period of time to see the exhibits that are there. Among the exhibits happen to be German millers who brought in the machinery that had been invented in Europe, but had been based on Oliver Evans's inventions of the steel mills. And he takes one look at this and said, this is perfect. What we can do with the oats is we can cook the oats to begin with, and then we can run them through these steel mills, and we'll end up with oatmeal. oatmeal is, the problem with Americans not eating oats is it takes an awful long time if unless you have the oat. And I mean, if you put it in water overnight or anything overnight, it's going to take an awful long time before the oat's going to break down and so you can actually consume it. So, but now the oatmeal, it's already been cooked once. You put it through this. All you really have to do is put it in hot water and add hot water to it. And so while it's not an instant breakfast, it's certainly an important breakfast. This is an important process that now other people discover. One is Henry Perkey. Anyone there hear of Henry Perkey? He's a little-known man. He's an inventor, too. He takes one look at these rollers and says, this is a really great idea. What we should do is put wheat through this, already cooked wheat, put a shredding machine on the outside of it, and then put a biscuit machine on the other side of that shredding machine, and we end up with shredded wheat. And so Perkey thinks this is a good idea. He has some problems with the process, and he decides he's going to go talk to John Harvey Kellogg and say, this is a really great invention here. And reportedly, from Perkey's standpoint, though not confirmed, with Kellogg's standpoint, Kellogg offers him $50,000 for the invention. Perkey declines it, goes off and creates a shredded wheat company, which will end up as a part of Nabisco, which ends up as a part of General Foods. So you have this whole process that goes on at a later time. In any case, Kellogg looks at this and says, well, you know what? Why don't we start rolling other things through these steel rollers? One of the things that he rolls through it is, and he ends up with, cornflakes. So cornflakes really starts off as a health food in Battle Creek, Michigan, in the sanitarium, and it's a process that Kellogg will say, well, let's try and run other products through it as well. And he runs a whole series of different products through. The only ones that have survived are nut butters. How many of you have heard of nut butters? If you go to health food stores, you can get nut butters today. Most of you have consumed nut butters, at least one type of nut butter, which is? Peanut butter is a vegetarian conspiracy, all right? These vegetarians start putting peanuts through these rollers and end up with stuff coming out the other side. Now, they figured out you don't really need to put them through rollers. All you need to do is put them through grinders. Now, grinders were around for 20, 30 years prior to this time, but you don't have commercial grinders until the 1880s. And as soon as commercial grinders come in, they can grind up a lot of things. They start grinding up peanut butter, and really, vegetarians go and knock on doors of their neighbors and say, would you like to buy a little of this peanut butter that we have here? And within a period of 10 years from the time that John Harvey Kellogg invents it and patents the process, by the way, although he claims later on he didn't, I've got the patents, he takes this out. It becomes one of the hit products in America. And virtually every community is going to have a peanut factory. Now, the problem with the peanut factories is relatively simple. Most Americans don't like fresh peanuts ground up. Some of us do. Do any of you like fresh peanuts that are ground up, there's problems with them. What's the problem? Anybody? What? It depends on what's in, what else you put in them, and it depends on the peanuts too. But they can be very bitter, and so commercial makers of peanut butter decide they want to do something quite different. And am I all right? Okay. Commercial makers decide they want to do something different, and what they're going to do is add sugar to it. So now sugar is about one-third of the content of peanut butter, and John Harvey Kellogg is now furious with this additive to it, and needless to say, considers this one of the horrible things, just like Sylvester Graham would have considered that earlier on. I've talked a long time about a process. I want to now go back. The process that Oliver Evans created is called continuous processing. Does that name ring a bell with you? Every single process, almost all processed food in America is made by that principle, where it starts and totally is operated by machinery and comes out the other end. That is the way most processed foods are made today. Likewise, Americans with the Erie Canal stop buying local food. It only start with the Erie Canal, with the Transcontinental Railroad. You ended local cuisine and you began national cuisine. And when you begin to have container ships in the 1950s, you begin to shift to a much more global environment in terms of our culinary life. And so these are changes that happen. To the extent that Americans were aware of these changes and aware of the implications, they embraced them. They loved these shifts and changes that went on. And maybe no one knew all the consequences that were behind there. For instance, in cereal, anyone know what the percentage of sugar is in Trix, I guess, Captain Crunch? It's how much?
35.
Go up. It's almost 50%. And by the way, they used to, well, I won't get into it, but they used to have, in the last month, they used to have smart choice typed on it. Now they've removed it, so I can't complain about it anymore. But in any case, you have these shifts and changes that went on in American diet. What I've tried to do in this book is not be normative. My goal was not to make value judgments. I have opinions on many of the topics that are there, and if I'm asked, I will tell you my opinions. But this book, I tried to say two things. If you like the American food system the way it is, it's largely efficient, it's largely low cost. Americans spend less on food than any other group of people in the world. 8% of our take-home pay goes into food, acquiring food. Anyone know what the French percentage is of take-home pay? 18%. So it shows you that different groups of people make different choices with regard to food. Americans tend to want speed. That's there before food comes along. It's before McDonald's. It's before all of the things that we think of today as part of fast food. So all I can do is say you have a large number of parts of American culture that come into food and have shaped the food the way we have it today. And if you don't like that system, then part of the message is, if you're going to change it, you're going to have to change American culture along with it. And so it's not an easy task to make the shifts and changes that are there.
This is Deconstructing Dinner, produced in Nelson, British Columbia at Kootenai Co-op Radio, CJLY. I'm John Steinman. Today's episode is truly in the spirit of deconstructing our food and features a talk delivered by Andrew Smith, a writer and lecturer on food and culinary history. His latest book is titled Eating History: 30 Turning Points in the Making of American Cuisine. Andrew teaches culinary history at the New School in New York City. He's the editor-in-chief of the Oxford Encyclopedia of Food and Drink in America, and he's the author or editor of 14 other books, including The Tomato in America, Early History, Culture, and Cookery, and Popped Culture, A Social History of Popcorn in America. Andrew was recorded speaking in November 2009 at the Kansas City Public Library in Kansas City, Missouri. In this second half of the show, we'll listen in on some of the questions and answers that rounded off Andrew's talk. Questions covered the history of government involvement in food, the history of food advertising, and this question on the history of Cracker Jacks.
Cracker Jack starts off with a German immigrant. Anybody hear of German immigrants before? By the way, anybody know what the largest group of immigrants coming in from what country? The largest group of Americans today who recognize their heritage from that country. Anyone know what it is? How about England? How many think in England? No? How about Italian? How many think Italian? How many think Irish? How many think Mexican? I asked this question in Los Angeles 2 weeks ago and they all raised their hand. It's German, the number one ethnic heritage of that Americans identify. 41 million Americans identify their heritage as German. And Germans had a huge impact on the food. And one of the impact happened to be by the name of Frederick Ruckheimer. Frederick Ruckheimer comes into the United States, works on a farm not far from Chicago, just before the Chicago fire. When the fire burns down much of the city, he goes into the city to help reconstruct it, decides that construction work really wasn't for him, and that what he wanted to do was sell food to the workers who were there. And he goes into the popcorn business. Now, you may not think that is a profitable business to go in, but people made fortunes on selling popcorn throughout the late 19th century and early 20th century on the street. So the problem is, as soon as he started making a fortune, there were a lot of other popcorn vendors, and so he had to vary his product. So he started adding in things, making flavorings and whatnot. In 1893, at the time of the World's Fair, he was not at the World's Fair, but he was on the outside of the fair selling to people going to and from the fair. He hit a wonderful combination of popcorn, caramel, and peanuts. And he doesn't really name it for 3 years. It's then called Cracker Jack. There's lots of different versions on how it got its name. But all of a sudden, he decides that it just is a nice product for Chicago, but really America should have the rest of this enjoyment here. And so he begins to sell and advertise Cracker Jack throughout the United States. It is the first commercial national snack food. And prior to that time, Americans would have been opposed to consuming snack food. Why would Americans have been opposed to consuming snack food? It's what your mothers all told you. Why can't you consume a cookie before dinner? It destroys your appetite, all right? How many of you had your appetite destroyed by that cookie? I consume cookies now before dinner and think that that's going to destroy my appetite. It doesn't work for me, but I guess it did in the 19th century. So all I can do is say snack food was not something that was commonly a part of the American diet. It was frowned upon by medical professionals, including John Howery Kellogg, including Sylvester Graham, including virtually every other medical professional. They were consumed mainly at fairs and at circuses and things of that sort. But now we're moving in. You can consume this every day, any day that you want to, by simply going down to a local store, buying your Cracker Jack and eating it. So they had this shift and change. It creates the snack food industry, which is today a $30 billion business. So from that, I trace the other snack foods that are common in America today, potato chips, obviously, and candy of one sort or another, and chocolate. But it begins there. That's the first one that I could find that was national, that was advertised in that way. I think that's a great story. Sorry.
Wasn't the question I came to ask, but when did they put the prize in Cracker Jacks?
When did they put the prizes? It wasn't at first. The first Cracker Jacks were actually in barrels, and there was a problem with the barrels. Can anyone imagine what the problem with a barrel would be? It's moisture. That's one problem. What else? It's mice. How many of you are into mice and Cracker Jack? Most of food in America was served a commodity, and it was served was in barrels. So you would walk into a store. If you wanted flour, for instance, you would go in, pick up the flour, and put it into a bag. You wouldn't do that. Actually, the grocer would do that, the person who was operating the store. And then that would then be sold to you by weight. And that was how Cracker Jack and most of the other foods in America were sold. Needless to say, that didn't work out. The moisture came in. You had problems with vermin coming in. It wasn't appetizing when you had a lot of insects and you were pulling them out. So they decided to go to a box. But the problem was they needed to figure out a system that you could have as a box that would prevent moisture from getting in. And if those of us who can remember the old days of Cracker Jack, they used to come in three different packages inside. There was a paper inside, there was a cardboard box on the outside, and there was wax covering on the outside. All that was to keep the moisture out. Well, needless to say, when you made that shift, you could also advertise on it. And the first thing that they did was say, well, in order to do this, this is a children's target. And this is the first time that any food in America had been targeted at children. It was unthinkable. It was not a good business plan. Children did not have money. Children don't have money today. What do they have? They have parents and they have pester power, all right? Now, pester power operates. I know that none of you would ever give in to your children about something like this. I did on occasion just to make my kids feel happy, all right? But in any case, once you have it given to children, you've got to have something that children can get other than the Cracker Jacks themselves. And so they started putting coupons in the packages. They're not the first to put coupons in. It actually is soap. The soap company started putting coupons in. So they liked the idea, and so they started putting coupons in, and you had to do this. So in 1910, they decided, well, what they really need to do, why do the coupons, and the kids have to send the stuff in, then we have to send it out, and it costs a lot, so let's start putting toys in them. And they put all sorts of toys. They had, I think, the first baseball cards, if you could correct me on that, but the first complete set, I think it's 1916, 1917. We all know what happened during the World Series in that time. Needless to say, I won't get into that. Baseball season's over. Did you hear about the Yankees and the World Series? Is it something? I just thought I'd ask that, just in case. So the answer is that's when it starts. It has toys, and the toys were incredible. There are people who collect Cracker Jack toys. Anybody collect them in here? Oh, if you go on eBay, if you have any, you make a fortune. And it's really, there's a whole society. They have a meeting on an annual basis. They come and talk about this. And it's almost everything now has a group like that. That I think they're wonderful. I think they keep going.
Author Andrew Smith. In this next clip, a member of the audience poses a question on the history of government involvement in the food industry. In his response, Andrew Smith refers to one of the most well-known exposés of the meat industry, Upton Sinclair's 1906 book, The Jungle.
You talked about medical doctors and ministers telling us how to eat. When did the government get in the business of telling us how to eat, and how did that come about?
Oh, I was hoping you'd ask. My next book, which I finished, is actually on the American Civil War. And the answer is the government played no role in food until the American Civil War. And at this point, four major bills were, as soon as the South seceded from the Union and left Congress, four bills were passed within a matter of 2 months. They were all bills that had been presented for decades prior to that time, but it was the Southerners that blocked every single one, in part due to states' rights. They believed states' rights, they believed the federal government shouldn't do anything. And so, therefore, one of the things that was passed almost immediately was the creation of the United States Department of Agriculture. The United States Department of Agriculture was created in 1862, and it is from the USDA that you have the beginning of federal government role in food. So that's the first thing. The pure food movement starts off in states. States did the best that they possibly could to make sure that bakers weren't putting plaster into their bread and canners were actually putting products in that wouldn't make you sick. I hate to say this, there was a canner in Massachusetts in 1890 who wanted to make ketchup, but the problem was he didn't have any tomatoes. He did have a lot of apples, so he ground up the apples, and then the problem is the apples weren't red, so he put red paint in, and a number of people died due to that. So there are thousands and thousands of examples of that that appear in newspapers. The problem was states couldn't control what happened in other states. So you could produce ketchup in one place in one state and then ship it across state lines, which is in fact what happened. So you had for a 30 or 40 year period of time, you had an attempt to create a pure food law in the federal government. And it was consistently defeated by corporations. The corporations saying, this is our right to do what we want to do, and we'll police ourselves, and a whole series of other reasons. And believe, I know this is going to shock everybody. They gave money to politicians. I know. It was surprising when I found that out. Now, one of the chapter that I loved the most in the book, writing, and the one I was surprised at, and even though I had read the book in my undergraduate years, I never realized the impact, was The Jungle. Does anybody ever hear of The Jungle? Upton Sinclair, does that name ring a bell with everybody? Upton Sinclair was a dime novelist, and as far as I know, The Jungle is the only book that made any splash in his life. I think he wrote probably about 100 novels, and that was the only one that made a difference. He had written about 20 or 30 dime novels prior to this time in a period of about 2 years, one of the things that happened in 1904 was there was a strike in Chicago of the slaughterhouses and stockyards. And immigrants, Ukrainian and German and Irish and a whole series of other immigrants, went out on strike. During this time, Upton Sinclair decides that he wants to write a manifesto for these workers and he wants to support them. And he creates this nice proclamation that says, you really need to pay people a decent wage. And when people die and they fall into the slaughterhouse, you really should take them out before you continue the process and things like that. Unheard of, I know, but those things were parts of this. And so he wrote this nice manifesto, and the workers loved it, and they actually printed up 35,000 copies of it, and it's available in lots of libraries. I don't know, Frank, if you got one or not, Henry. Yeah, but in any case, they've got one of these manifestos down there, and he had just published a book on the Civil War. He had failed in that. In the midst of the failure, one of the socialist editors wrote him a note saying, I'll give you $500 if you write a novel about something that promotes socialism in America. And he said, fine. So he wanted to write about the slaughterhouses in Chicago. He lives in New Jersey. He goes for 6 weeks to Chicago. He gets stories down of the workers and stories of other socialists who were there. Almost everything in The Jungle had been published previously, by the way. It wasn't anything. It was initially published in serial form. It was published then. He wanted to get it a novel. No publisher in America would touch the book the way it was. And he refused to make changes in it, so all the socialists got together, Jack London, Sinclair Lewis, and they gave him money to help fund the publication of it. And then at the last minute, a publisher got in and said, okay, fine, we'll publish it the way you want it. And it was from the instant that it was published, it had a huge impact on America. Now, the interesting thing was, one of the immediate things was the passage of the Meat Inspection Act, which gives the USDA the power to inspect meat, poultry, and eggs, a power that they still have today, and created the FDA, the second bill, the Food and Drug Act. And so you had the division even today of separation of this. And so here he is. He's complaining bitterly. He did not support the legislation. He was opposed to the legislation. What he said was, this legislation is going to help the corporations. And believe it or not, the legislation helped the corporations because it meant that Americans could buy their food with at least some feeling of security. And so lots of the problems disappeared despite all the complaints about corporations beforehand. Most of them embraced it, and immediately it changed what American diet was. So those are two things that are part of it. I love that chapter.
This is Deconstructing Dinner. We're listening to author Andrew Smith speaking in November 2009 in Kansas City, Missouri. Andrew is the author of Eating History, 30 Turning Points in the Making of American Cuisine. Today's episode is archived online at deconstructingdinner.ca and posted under the December 17th, 2009 episode. In this last clip, a member of the audience questions the history of food advertising. Andrew Smith introduces Quaker Oats as one of the first examples of national marketing of a food product. We'll also hear a question on the emergence of high fructose corn syrup.
Food advertising is really low-key until the 1870s, 1880s. There are canned food that's available. The advantage, the problem with canned food is you have no idea what's inside. And so the can makers began to put out labels which reflected what they thought was, what you hoped was inside when you bought it. And the labels are gorgeous. Have you seen the 19th century? I collect tomato labels. I like tomato. They're absolutely spectacular. And I think the library should have an exhibition on labels, by the way. So I just mentioned that, saying labels are great. So you begin to have advertising. As soon as you have labels, you have names on that. And there were certainly specialty food operations that began to have advertising. The first was the Atlantic the Atlantic Tea Company. Does any of you know anything about the Atlantic Tea Company? How many of you have heard of A&P? It starts off as the Atlantic Tea Company. When the Transcontinental Railroad connects up the eastern part of the United States with San Francisco, they then become the Atlantic and Pacific Tea Company, and then they start selling other things other than tea, so they just become A&P. They are the first chain grocers in America. They were hated. They were hated in America by grocers because they could buy products for a large number of their stores more cheaply than could a small grocer that could only deal with them. So when you increase the ability to buy a lot of amounts of products, you can decrease the price and you can run everybody else out of business. And that's essentially what A&P did until the rise of other supermarkets. And this principle is followed by the world's number one grocer. Walmart's the world number one grocer. They were not selling any groceries 15 years ago. So they applied the process that they have with their other products, they applied it into food, and today they're the world's largest distributor of food. So you have these shifts and changes. What happens in the 1870s is Quaker Oats. Quaker Oats is the first nationally advertised product, and it just so happens that a man by the name of Henry Crowell works with Schumacher. They have a love-hate affair. In the end, Henry Crowell takes over the company and creates the Quaker Oats. And in the midst of that, he decides that what they need is an advertising campaign. But how do you advertise when there's no radio, no television, there's no internet, there's no real magazines at the time that focused on food? There were national magazines, but they focused on other matters. And so his decision was he was going to create this. He's not a Quaker, by the way. It has nothing to do with Quakers. He just thought Quakers looked good on the package. And so he created this image of the Quaker, which we still have with us today. And he decides that what we need to do is dress people up like Quakers and put them on railroads and move them around the country and give Quaker Oats away, small boxes of it, and this is the way we can convince Americans to eat oats, which would not have been consumed by Americans, even mainstream Americans prior to that time. And so the train starts off in Des Moines, Iowa, ends up in Portland, then goes down the coast to San Francisco, then heads back across the country, and then from that on out they had about 20 people dressed up like Quakers who were going around promoting it. Now they had advanced men that would go into the local town, they would go to the local newspapers and they would create puff pieces. Anyone know what a puff piece is? I'm sure none of you have ever seen a puff piece before. It's where the company pays the local paper to have an article appear about them that they write. And so I know that this doesn't happen today, but in the 19th century, that was a typical process without having any announcement that it was an advertisement or anything else. So large numbers of people showed up when the train pulled into a train station. You had literally the whole community. They paid boys to go around, knock on doors and say, the Quaker is coming. And this was the way you had it. They then began every other thing that you think of, from sex to advertising on streetcars to advertising on barns, everything else that you think of prior to the time of radio and television, they invented. And they followed the principles that had in part been established prior to that time by patent medicines, which we won't get into, but there's a whole new story on that. So that's when you have the beginning. As soon as Quaker Oats does that, everyone else decides they need to do that. Now, the person who says, no, I will not advertise, is John Harvey Kellogg. John Harvey Kellogg is opposed to advertising. He thinks all money should be spent on food and should be spent on healthful food and should not be expended on advertising. Most of the advertising budgets of food companies then, as almost for another 50 years, is almost 25% of the total budget of the company was going into advertising. So you have this shift and you have this change. Kellogg then says, I'm not going to advertise Kellogg's cornflakes. Now, he happened to have a brother. Who's his brother? Anybody know who his brother is? What? Well, not W.T., Will K. Kellogg, all right? And that's the name that appears on the Kellogg. And his brother decides that he needs to advertise or Kellogg's cornflakes is never going to make it. By this time, there were at least 60 different cereal companies in Battle Creek producing health foods and all being having no association with the sanitarium but claiming that they were a health food because they were from Battle Creek. And so the brothers had a split. They never spoke to each other except through lawyers at that point on. They had constant legal battles, it's a tragic story. But Will Kellogg says, if we don't advertise, we aren't going to make it. He creates the Kellogg's Company in 1906, and he begins massive national advertising as well as C.W. Post. Now, C.W. Post is another person who starts off the cereal advertising. C.W. Post is supposedly a patient at the sanitarium, but he decides that he really doesn't need to stay in the sanitarium. He'll just come during the day and get the services, and then he's going to live in the town. And the rumor was that every night he came back and then went out and had a great time on the town. That's not verified by primary source data, but it is later on. He learned all of the secrets of the sanitarium and began to create commercial products. The first commercial product wasn't a cereal at all, and it just went out of sale about 4 years ago. Anyone know what it is? It's Postum. Anyone hear of Postum? If you had Postum, you would know it. All I can do is say Postum is a bizarre product. But that was a product that rather than drink coffee or tea, which John Harvey Kellogg was opposed to, they'd put on that. He then duplicated John Harvey Kellogg did with cornflakes and put Post Toasties out. That came out the same year that he had Kellogg's cornflakes beginning to advertise. And they absolutely duplicated each other from that point on.
When did they start putting in high fructose corn syrup instead of
sugar? That's a good question. How many? Also, most of you can't remember back. I'm sorry, another part to the question?
And also, yes. Is it just a high fructose corn syrup as opposed to regular corn syrup that negates the effect of leptin, in the hormone that
I'm not a medical professional, but I will answer your question anyway. Never stop me. The first part to that is simple. Most of you can't remember back to the 1970s, can you? Is this something?
Oh, yeah.
Some of you can. I know you were a child at the time, but and you can remember a Secretary of Agriculture by the name of Earl Butz. Do any of you know Earl Butz? Whether you like him or not, he made a huge shift and change in American agriculture. And one of the things that he did was say, we need to protect American farmers who are raising corn. And one of the ways that we can do this is by increasing tariffs on imported sugarcane. At that point, the United States had no sugarcane production except in Hawaii. And so consequently, they increased, during the early 1970s, they increased the tariffs on sugarcane. making it possible to use corn to convert it to high fructose corn syrup. And so from that point on, you have, within a matter of 5 years of the changes there, you have the elimination of sugar cane from virtually all of the soft drinks. And today, with a few exceptions, now some companies are advertising that they have real sugar cane. And if you go to Mexico or if you go to Canada, you can have real sugar cane in your product. And high fructose corn syrup was, in fact, the product that was substituted simply because it was less costly. For the medical side to it, I really can't answer that. I've been engaged in a large number of discussions with other people. It either is processed exactly the same way as sugar cane itself, or it's not, depending on who you believe. There is no known proven evidence that high fructose corn syrup causes any medical problems, with the major exception of weight. I raise this. It's embarrassing for me, but I will raise this. If your body is in perfect balance, meaning your exercise calories equals the input calories, if it's in perfect balance, and you consume 1 12-ounce can of soda a day for a year, anybody know what will happen to your weight? 12 pounds, or 12 to 15 pounds, depending on who you are. That is what does. So you have concerns about particularly teenagers again. And again, with adults, I don't care. Adults, you make your own decisions. But with kids, I do care. And the average is something like 72% of teenagers consume 1 12-ounce can of soda every day. So you begin to take a look at this huge influence that it's had on American society. And that's one of those ones that I will take a stand on and say, that's not right. So.
Author Andrew Smith, speaking in November 2009 in Kansas City, Missouri. Andrew is the author of Eating History, 30 Turning Points in the Making of American Cuisine. He teaches culinary history at the New School in New York City. Today's recording was made available by the Kansas City Public Library. And that was this week's edition of Deconstructing Dinner, produced and recorded at Nelson, British Columbia's Kootenai Co-op Radio. I've been your host, John Steinman. A thanks to my technical assistant, John Ryan. The theme music for Deconstructing Dinner is courtesy of Nelson area resident Adam Shake. This radio show was provided free of charge to campus community radio stations across the country and relies on the financial support from you, the listener. Support for the program can be donated through our website at deconstructingdinner.ca or by dialing 250-352-9600.